Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers. Season 2, here we are. Unfortunately, Robin Griffiths can't make it. He's walking in the mountains of Canada somewhere, I believe. But my name is Thomas W.P. I'm a part-time A-level only teacher of physics, and I'm joined by Patrick Kaplow. Hey, Patrick, how are you doing?
So nice to hear you. What a great summer it's been. Restful, but I am geared up and ready for classes in the fall.
Yes, we should say Patrick is a high school teacher in Windham, New Hampshire.
Thank you.
My summer's been a bit weird. I completely lost track of time. It reminded me of my youth when the summer holidays stretched out forever. I haven't had one like this for ages. I guess it's because my kids are getting older. But I've completely lost the plot.
Isn't it delightful? I mean, I feel like the rhythms of teaching keep you youthful. You have a beginning and an end and a period of rest. I love it.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this summer holiday, but I have completely lost track of time. I actually was going to interview someone, sorry Moses, and first of all I emailed him the day before saying, I hope you're still on for tomorrow, and he said, but it's next Thursday. And then next Thursday, I sat down with my family. It was the only day we had to watch the last two episodes of Stranger Things Season 3. They insisted I muted my phone, so I had my phone muted. And when we finished the last episode, all these messages from Moses saying, hello, hello. So huge apologies to Moses, and Moses Rifkin, that is, who will come. I think he's forgiven me, and we will have him on the podcast, and he's going to talk about who does physics, and looking at why people are underrepresented, like black people and women. I'm looking forward to talking to him, and I'm really sorry, Moses. So, Patrick, when does your term start? We're recording this on Friday, the 30th of August. When do you start?
Students come back on Tuesday. The teachers have been back this week. And so we have our kind of pre-service preparation days, and we get a little pep talk from the superintendent and the school board, and we hear about new initiatives, and then we go do what teachers always do, is they have to prepare for the deliverables and the hard work of the academic year. So, you know, I've been doing things like prepping my syllabus and thinking about maybe new initiatives, new policies, new labs. I worked on some exciting new lab work over the summer that I'm very excited to share at different times throughout the podcast. So I got some new things to share.
Yeah, so I got the impression from Twitter that Americans go back a week earlier than us. So I go back next Monday. We have two teacher-only days. And then the 2 years come in, the people who are starting at their next key stage in England. And then so the summer kids in on Wednesday, some on the rest on Thursday. But that, not all schools in England and Wales will do that. The fee-paying schools, I shouldn't think Robin goes back for another month or something. They get. I think the more you pay, the less you get is the motto in time. So he probably goes back, you know. He probably goes back, seriously, the second week in September, I would think. Which is why he's gloriously tramping around the Rockies, I think.
Schools in the United States are kind of the same. The southern schools tend to start a whole lot earlier than the northern schools do. So they've been going for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks at least already. Some of them are back in, you know, first or second week in August. And I think we're the very last ones in the U.S. to get started. So we're like 3 to 4 weeks later, you know, first week in September.
Does that mean you finish later?
It does. But our national tests for students that are taking advanced placement exams are all in the first 2 weeks of May, regardless of when you start. So we really have less time to prepare.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you do. I mean, it sounds like the start of your year is similar to ours. We have pep talks, so we have time to prepare, and off we go.
Maybe I'm a bit of a curmudgeon about this. I'm a salty veteran, but we kind of bear through it. And, you know, we listen to people with their, you know, who are very excited about school-wide initiatives. And we know, you know, for many of us who have been at it for 5, 10, 15 years or longer, we know that, you know, they'll lose steam following through on these kinds of things within a week. And we have to focus on the things that matter, which are deliverables in the first week of school.
I am shocked at your attitude, Patrick. No, you're not. I can't believe anyone doesn't pay full attention to those pep talks.
You're as bad as I am, Thomas.
It just sounds exactly the same. We'll get a summary of the exam results, and I don't think we want to talk about that. That would be the senior management teaching podcast, wouldn't it?
Right.
But
yeah.
I'm excited for next year because we have a new head of department who's a physics teacher.
That's really exciting.
That is exciting, and he's made a good impression on me so far. And hopefully we'll get him on the podcast. I'm not sure what he does. When he came for interview, I said, "Oh, I did the physics teaching podcast." And he said, I think I've heard of that." I'm not sure he was fully truthful. But hopefully we'll get him on because he is into his practical physics as well. So that'll be fun. And I also have lined up one of our physical education teachers, timetable to teach physics, because the first, I think, six letters of physical education is the first six letters of physics. Mm. And he is going to do an audio diary about teaching year seven's physics.
Sounds interesting.
That will be interesting. He's a good friend of mine, actually. I'm sort of coaching him through, and he's already listened to the episode on forces for 11-year-olds and was telling me what he'd planned today. So hopefully that will come true, and that we'll have that to follow him through the year. That'd be exciting.
Sounds fun. So what, Thomas, do you do on the very first day of classes? Students walk into your room, they find their seats. Well, first of all, do you do a seating chart or do you let them pick their seats? And then second, after they find their seats, what comes out of your mouth?
Well, remember, I'm A-level only, so they are being treated like adults, and we're preparing them for university. So, no, I don't do a seating plan. Last year, actually, my younger years, which would be your junior year, they were a bit annoying, and I did move them around a bit, but I haven't done that for years. And the first lesson I would do, I go straight into it. I was thinking about this in bed last night, actually. I have something I really like to do. I'm not sure if I mentioned in the podcast, where I pre-measure 2 points either side of a tree, 13 meters apart. This just happens to be at the right distance for this tree. And they're not line of sight, so they're directly behind the trunk. And I tell them, I take them outside, and there's these two X's on the ground. And I say, right, here's one X on the ground. I have secretly marked an X exactly 13 meters away through the center of the tree. You've got 15 minutes to draw a chalk X on the floor where that point is. And I've got tape measures and meter rulers and clicky wheels and all that stuff. Have I talked about this in the podcast?
I don't think so. So they use geometry then?
They use geometry, and they use the cosine rule, and they use Pythagoras, and they use equilateral triangles, and they draw these X's. And they all, you can imagine, they're all in a circle of about a meter diameter. And they say, where is the point? Where is the point? And so after half an hour, I grab the tape measure, I run it past the trunk of the tree, 13 meters, and draw an X, and draw a big circle around all their points and say, there you are. That's where it is, about 13 meters away, give or take half a meter. And it's a way I introduce the idea of two significant figures. Press and press and press and press on two significant figures being enough.
Right.
And, you know, even a meter diameter, which is a big circle, which all their X's will be inside, that's more than two. That's 13 plus or minus half a meter, isn't it? It's more than it's too precise, really.
Hmm.
So my whole first lesson is about how important I find two sig figs.
Hmm. This is just a 60 second or 2 minute version of that. I take a meter ruler and I run it through a belt sander and remove all the markings from it. And then I say, find the area in square centimeters of the desk that you're sitting at. And then we have a discussion about significant figures in a similar way. Although I like yours a lot. I like the idea that kids are getting out of their seats, they're going outside. It's a great lesson. Good idea.
I love your meter ruler. Of course, you could just give them a piece of string with a meter marked in it, couldn't you?
I've even gone so far as to trim a meter ruler after I've sanded it so that it's not actually a meter, just to talk about systemic errors, you know, or calibration. So the same measurement every time is going to introduce the same error.
Systematic errors. Yeah, I've always had a meter ruler. I have it at home now, actually, because I don't have my own lab particularly. Or I have recently, but I have a ruler. I've sawn off the bottom centimeter and a half. And I would just put it in with the other rulers.
And nobody looks at the markings and says...
No one looks at the zero, do they? They all look at the other end. So that's quite interesting. And I also wonderfully have a thermometer that looks right but does not read the right temperature, massively wrong. And I just get the technician to stick that in with the thermometers every now and then, not all the time, just occasionally to see if they notice that as well. It reads about 10 degrees out.
Great.
So what do you do the very first lesson?
Well, I shudder to think about what it would feel like to be a student going to all of your classes for the first day and listening to your teachers drone on and on about the course syllabus and the rules and the expectations. And so I think, like you, my thinking is they walk in through the door. Now, I do use a seating chart, and the only reason is I need to learn their names. I think I'd really struggle with that without some sort of a chart. My first day involves a black box. I think it's maybe about a quarter of a meter cubed. And inside the black box, I'm not ready to reveal what's inside the black box in the podcast, but, and I'll explain why in a second. The box is made out of foam core, and there's a funnel on the top of the box, a plastic funnel, and then there's a little copper pipe, quarter-inch copper pipe coming out the sides, one of the side of the, near the bottom of the cube. And I have a student add 200 milliliters of water. I have them measure it out and add it, and nothing happens. They put it into the funnel that leads into the top of the box. They put in another 200 milliliters, nothing happens. Then they put in another 200 milliliters, and then all of a sudden water starts to come out the little copper pipe opening at the bottom of the cube. And I feign being surprised, and I'm like, whoa, you know, what do we have here? So I immediately throw a beaker to start collecting the water that's coming out. And, you know, lo and behold, it fills a liter and 2 liters and 3 liters of water, and eventually peters out, you know, after maybe 3.5 liters. And so I give them these kind of whiteboards, and I have them work in groups, and I say, come up with an idea for what's inside the black box. And so, you know, people come up with crazy ideas. They come up with ideas that don't pass, you know, rational muster, where you say, you know, we can kind of poke holes in this, and there's some great ideas on how this could be made. And so maybe there's 6 or 8 groups in the class, and we write the ideas up on the board, and the students maybe make a 1 or 2 minute presentation on what they think is inside the box. And then we propose perhaps another test. And the second test somebody might propose is adding another 200 milliliters of water. And I say, okay, well, if we do that, based on what you said was inside the box, what will happen? Will 200 milliliters come out? Will nothing come out? And so, again, people have come up with crazy ideas. There could be like a little bucket that's asymmetrically balanced and it tips over. And there's people who come up with ideas that there's a balloon in there that gets larger as you add water and it pops. And there's at least 10, 15 different general ideas. So we do the second test. But before we do the second test, each group has to state whether what they think will happen based on the second test. And of course, there's not uniformity in what will happen, meaning, you know, group one might think 200 liters will come out. Group two might think nothing comes out based on what they think is inside the box. We do the test, and only one of those groups can be right. And so we start with, you know, 8 different ideas, and we might whittle it down to 3 ideas and eventually 2 ideas. And, you know, the idea is to create an experience for students to see what, the nature of science. This is a hypothesis. We do additional batteries of tests on them to point towards, you know, a better hypothesis. Eventually we have a consensus or near consensus, and we call that a theory. And so that 40-minute exercise is designed to kind of really be a microcosm for the nature of science more generally.
That is a direct analogy to, I think, Carol Kenrick's episode 8, I think, the mystery tube that she introduced, which is exactly the same, much simpler, just a tube with four strings coming out.
Right, yeah.
Do you ever let them know what's in the box?
So that's the key. I say, tell me about Ernest Rutherford. You know, do we get to pop open the nucleus? Do we get to pop open the atom and take a closer look at the nucleus? Of course, the answer is no. Like, all of this is still a theory. There's no certainty. So we never open the box. And that move right there gets kids asking me about the box for the rest of the academic year. They'll be leaving for Christmas break and say, all right, Mr. Kaplow, we've been in your class for 4 months now. Tell me what's inside the box. And, you know, it's just a burning curiosity for them. And I never tell them. I have to take that thing out of my classroom, because if I leave it in there, they'll start rummaging through cupboards looking for the box because they want to know what's inside.
You're making me think I want to change my first lesson now, because I've got all those mystery tubes I made last year. So, yeah, that's a really nice way of starting, isn't it? So I'm teaching mechanics first off. So I'll be going straight into vectors and kinematics. What are you teaching first to your older kids?
Same. We kind of do Newtonian mechanics. In AP Physics 1, we do Newtonian mechanics, which includes rotational mechanics, you know, beyond, I think circular motion and gravitation would be a part of most, you know, introductory physics classes, but not all introductory physics classes will also do rotational mechanics. Will you do that in A level?
Well, you helped me through the rotational dynamics, didn't you, which was an optional module on my A level that I teach. We have the core, and then you can teach as many of the optional modules as you like, but I only have time to do one because it's amazing. Some people finish the course incredibly quickly, but I don't. I do a lot of practical work, and I go through it at a pace that means we choose one optional module. And I chose engineering this year, or they chose engineering, and you helped me through the rotational dynamics. But circular motion and SHM, simple harmonic motion, they would be a senior topic.
Right. Well, but let
often,
me ask you
often,
this.
Often you'd teach it right at the end of the junior year if you had time, and actually I squeezed some of it in the last year.
Thomas, in the podcast, you emphasize doing practical work, like every week that those words come out of your mouth. And so from what you've just told me, it sounds like there's almost a disincentive in like from a time perspective to focus on practical work if a teacher is tasked with teaching A level.
Absolutely. And I did some assessment for one of the exams boards here where I went out and did it was a science practical advisor, because they totally changed the way practical work was assessed. I went to one school in November. They had finished the entire course.
Wait, in November?
Just couldn't believe it. I was thinking, what are you going to do? And then when these kids did their practical, it showed how they'd finished the course. I mean, they didn't know what they were doing.
And is the point of doing a finishing in November so you can prepare for the exam from November?
Oh my God, the kids would kill you. You know, if you start preparing for the exam in November, the kids would murder you by the end. They'd be so bored.
So what were they doing in that school from November to June?
Well, I was only there for a day, but I imagine they were just reviewing the content, going over it again. And I have no idea. I have no idea. You know, for me, I always tell the kids, I will finish the course on the last day before the Easter holidays, and you will have a mock the first day of the Easter holidays, and that will tell you how you're going to do in the final exam. And that pretty much is a very good indicator. They usually go up a grade. Well, they didn't so much this year. But my results were okay. How are yours?
Yeah, good. You know, they haven't changed a whole lot. I mean, they're good. I'm happy with them. There's a part of me, and maybe this reveals kind of a deficit on my part. I mean, I care about the tests and I don't, right? Like I can throw my energy into doing my absolute best. And then if the exam results are average or, you know, above average, when I say average or above average, I mean from my personal historical results for my students, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to, you know, be upset about that? Like,
It's an existential crisis, isn't it? I mean, all I want is the kids to achieve as well as I think they deserve. They don't always get as well as they could, because I don't think some kids work hard enough, or some do better than they should because they work unbelievably hard and come for help all the time. But I always have an existential crisis. You know, if I think student A should get an A and they get an A, perhaps they could have got an A star with a different teacher. Do you have that feeling?
Yeah, I try to I try to minimize the amount of time I spend with regrets. I think you're right. I think we all, when we get these exam results in, we say, you know, we could be so much better. You know, what am I doing that's not optimal for my students? Of course, you develop relationships with these people, your students, and so you feel badly when they don't perform where you think they can. I agree. There is a period of time, but I tend to be very quick to nip that in the bud. And, I emotionally move past it as quickly as I can.
Yeah. It comes with experience of teaching, doesn't it? That you have to cross that bridge into actually, you've got to move on. But no, my results are okay. I mean, they get a target based on their prior performance when they come to the school, and they're all within one grade of their target. And the targets are always too hard. One wonderful kid beat his target by 2 grades, made me look good.
But don't you think there are other goals? I mean, certainly scoring well on the exam is important, but what if all of the students who take your class, who score well on the exam, hate physics? You're a taskmaster.
I know, that's such a good point. Yeah, I hope they don't. And funnily enough, I bumped into a kid who bounced up to me, Mr. WP, guess what? I'm just finished my physics degree and I'm starting a master's. Whoa. So sometimes it works.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it works a lot. I think the formula is you have to keep your eye on at least both of those things. Yes, they do have to score well on the exam, but you also have to make an environment that keeps them coming back for more.
And an environment that prepares them for university. I feel very strongly about that. Like, they've got to be fully independent by the end of the second year. I mark very little towards the end of their time, because they're just not going to get that feedback at university. Mm-hmm. I just mark tests by the end of the 2 years, and they sort of look at me sideways, and I say, no, just show me you've done the homework, and I don't need to check it because you've got all the answers. You should be checking it, and that's what you've got to do when you get to uni. You've got to be self-supporting.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think we've digressed quite a lot, and we really should start, otherwise we're going to start with a super long episode. Now, we have asked Robin to do a little piece of audio in his phone from the Rocky Mountains, just on his thoughts about starting the new year. So if he sends us that, I will feed that in here.
So what I'm looking forward to this year, well, obviously I've been out of teaching for a couple of years, so I'm getting back into teaching. So new school, new schemes of work, and new qualifications, which is all very exciting and fresh and new. And I do actually quite like that. I like teaching new courses and having new challenges like that, because I think it does make the job less stale. So I'm looking forward to that. I think what, I guess, 9 years in the classroom has taught me about that is that I need to be a bit forgiving of myself, particularly in the first year. First time you teach things, invariably they're not the best, and it's quite glaring when you reflect on them how much you have to do and how much you have to change, if you get me. And that I think you need to be conscious of. And I notice a lot of things around Twitter at the moment where people are asking, NQTs and trainees who are about to start are asking for tips. And I think that's the thing. Don't be too hard on yourself. You're not going to be an expert in anything you do the first time around. You've got to give yourself a chance to make a few mistakes, to reflect on those, and to get a bit better. So take it easy on yourself. It's going to be an exhausting year the first time you do anything. It's going to be quite tiring. So just, set your ambitions nice and realistically. Don't try and take on too much. And I think that's one thing I always remember about teaching. In September, you come back, you've had a long summer holiday, you're keen, you've been thinking about a lot of things. You want to do loads and loads of stuff, and you want to do loads and loads of new things. By December, you're going to be quite tired, and you're going to have had a bit of a slog, and unexpected things are going to have come up. So don't set yourself a huge to-do list that is just going to end up making you feel demoralized because you haven't done it. Set yourself a few, 2 or 3 targets that you want to achieve in the year, and make sure you focus on those. That would be my advice to NQTs, for what it's worth. I think that would be what I'd say. So over the summer, I've been reading a book called How I Wish I'd Taught Maths by Craig Martin. And that sounds like a bit weird for a physics teacher to do that, but I think physics and maths have a lot in common in terms of the concepts and the way they're taught. So I'm really interested by that. And what I really like about the book is it's very focused on looking at evidence. It wants evidence-based interventions and evidence-based teaching. It argues strongly for that. And also, it's very practical. So not only is it rooted in evidence, but also it's very practically focused. So I'm really looking forward to trying some of the ideas there, and particularly some of the things that have come to light over the last couple of years while I've been out of teaching, involving those in my teaching, things like cognitive science, working memory, retrieval practice, things like that. That's going to be my couple of things that I'm going to work on this year. So I'm looking forward to that. So I think the podcast has been fantastic, and the response to it has been overwhelming and really, really encouraging. I think, you know, you hear all these things about how Twitter and social media are very negative and things like that, but quite the opposite. I think the community of teachers that I've found on Twitter, particularly the community that have reached out to us on the podcast, have been fantastic. I'm really looking forward to serving that community, to working for physics teachers and teachers of physics. Anybody who's walking into a classroom with some physics to teach, no matter what their background, really looking forward to working with those folks, hearing how it's gone for them, hearing their tips, hearing their tricks, hearing what they do and how they make physics live in their classrooms. One of the main reasons you and I started this off, Thomas, I know we've talked about this a lot, is this idea that it can be quite a lonely existence, particularly as a physics teacher, because you tend to be either somebody who is a single solitary physics specialist in their classroom, or in their school, I should say, or you are someone who's been called on to teach physics and you're not very comfortable with the subject and there's nobody to go and ask about it. There's no specialists around in your school, which is why you've ended up teaching it anyway. So I think providing that professional community for people and really recognizing the professionalism of those folks and the heroic job they do is such an important subject. I can't believe, you know, looking at the increasing realization about climate change and the energy needs of humanity, you know, physics is going to be at the heart of that. It's such an important subject and we neglect it at our peril. So serving the community that is heroically holding that line for physics as a subject and therefore for the future research into all these really, really important areas, I think is going to be a privilege and an honour. And it's going to be really interesting. And you and I both have said we found it really interesting last year how it went off in a direction that we weren't necessarily expecting and that was really great. I'm looking forward to reaching out to more teachers across the world and across the English-speaking nations, I guess, and maybe even further beyond as well. Who knows? So I think that would be great. So if you're listening to this in, I don't know, Australia, Canada, South Africa, give us a shout. It'd be really great to hear how physics is taught in your countries. And that will be a treat this year, I'm sure. Right, I hope that gives you enough to be going on with, Thomas. I will talk to you next week. The mountains, by the way, are fantastic. Come to Canada, you would love it. Everybody's on a bike here, going up and down mountains. It's great.
So it's such a shame that Robin couldn't join us. He is literally walking in the Canadian Rockies at the moment and sent his apologies. He was going to try and come on by Skype. But we will hear how he's preparing for his return to teaching, his big money return to teaching, when he gets back next week.
I'm looking forward to hearing his stories both from Canada and from his first week or two back in the classroom.
I'm so excited for him being back in the classroom. It's such good news for the world.
I do.
He's a lovely teacher. Did you get away this summer? Did you go away?
Yeah, we spent a little bit of time out on Cape Cod. We did some camping out there. There's a great white shark population that follows the seals. And so on the Atlantic Ocean side, not the bay side of the Cape, when you visit those beaches, when we were there, they called people in because of great white shark sightings. I mean, it's bizarre. And then of course they say it's like 2 hours later and they're like, okay, you can go back in the water. And, you know, for like the first hour, people are about ankle deep, you know, but it's hot out and everybody wants to get in. But yeah. So that's interesting. How about yourself?
Oh, I went cycling in the Alps. Oh, I've always wanted to go to the Alps in the summer because I ski in the Alps. And I took along my bike and dragged my wife and daughter, one of my daughters, along and cycled some of the bits of the Tour de France. Absolutely brutal, but unbelievably beautiful. If you look at the photo for the gaffes episode we released, that's literally me cycling up the Col de Galibier, 2,600 meters above sea level.
And did you watch a lot of the Tour this year?
I love cycling, so I watch a lot of the cycling. Yeah. I may not be built like a cyclist. I'm a bit hefty, but I love the sport. So, yeah, I've watched a lot of it. Vuelta on at the moment. Mm. And obviously really useful being a cyclist because you have lots of wheels to play with when you're doing rotational dynamics.
I had to buy mine on Amazon.
The loft of my garage is full of wheels. Yeah. Right, Patrick, let's call a halt there. I was hoping to do a short one, but I think we're going to be over half an hour again. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. And I wish you all the success with your new classes next year. And hopefully you'll be available next week and we'll have Robin online. So have a good first week back at school.
Thank you,
and
Thomas.
I'll speak to you next week.
You as well. Pleasure to talk to you and see you soon.
You have been listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast with Robin Griffiths, Patrick Kaplow and me, Thomas WP. The podcast is produced and edited by me, Thomas WP. We're always looking for things to put in the podcast, so contact us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com or through Twitter, @PhysicsTP. There's several other ways of contacting us on our website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com.